On This Week in Our Rights, Doc, we talk about voter fraud and if technology can help solve it. Also, I have Brian Chi and Brian McHenry on, helping me talk with Sammy Ahmed from Hunt Club about talent acquisition and disrupting the headhunting market. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 303, recorded August 10, 2018. Hunt Club and Tech-Enabled Recruiting Service. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 33,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host for today, Louis Maresca, your guide through the world of the enterprise. But this world is pretty large, and we need some help from my friends. And today we have Brian Squared, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Brian, how are you today, my friend?
I'm doing well. I'm doing a lot of filling up of dumpsters, cleaning up my lab so I can actually walk and move things around. Woohoo! What a concept.
I think we all need a little bit of organization in our lives, so that's great. Of course, we have our other Brian and one of our newest cast members, Mr. Brian McHenry from FI Networks. Bam! How are you doing today, my friend?
Doing well. Wrestled some air conditioning issues in the house to the ground this week, so it's actually cool in the house, and I'm happy to report that the family is resting comfortably.
Fantastic. Well, today we're going to say Chibert and Bam. This way we can try to keep them separated, and hopefully we'll be able to keep it under control. Well, folks, we have a pretty great episode for you. And not only are we talking a little bit about voter fraud and how maybe technology can help that out, but of course, we're also talking with a guest and how they're disrupting the talent and headhunting aspect of the market. But first, let's jump in the blips. Now, I'm sure you're hearing more and more about Black Hat and DEF CON as the weeks go on, but especially since our co-host, Mr. Curtis Franklin, is there interviewing over 800 people, but we have to call them as we see them, right? Well, this one is no surprise, other than the fact that a person can crack your WPA2 Wi-Fi password faster than ever before. Now, we've seen Wi-Fi protocol attacks before in the past where people can crack your Wi-Fi password, but these previous attacks were done by waiting for someone to log into the network, capturing the four-way handshake process used to authenticate users with wireless access points called Extensible Authentication Protocol LAN, and use that brute force search for the password. Now, this new attack, which is actually found by accident, does not require the capture of the full four-way handshake. It attacks the RSNIE, or the Robust Security Network Information Element, of a single frame. Once the frame is captured from the Wi-Fi network, the PMKID, or the Pairwise Master Key ID, which is actually the key needed to establish a connection between a user and an access point, can be pulled out via packet capture tool and then brute force decrypted with Hashcat. How fast? Well, this can often be done in around 10 minutes or so, depending on the noise over the Wi-Fi channel. The brute force of the password is the only defense here. The more complex the password, the longer it takes to decrypt. Make your passwords long and complex to slow them down, but they're still going to come in whether you like it or not.
Microsoft has introduced an identity bounty, a new bug bounty program for various identity services offered by Microsoft. This program has payouts ranging from $500 all the way up to an eye-popping $100,000. While the value of bug bounty programs has been hotly debated for years in the information security community, this newest bounty program from Microsoft highlights a couple of important points. First, Microsoft is incredibly committed to delivering comprehensive identity services. From Microsoft accounts for consumers on Xbox and Live, as well as enterprise services like Azure Active Directory services, it's no secret that companies are vying for control of your identity on the internet, including Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft. Microsoft's huge install base for Active Directory services lend them a massive advantage in the enterprise. However, the more important point is that these services are nearly constantly under attack. Identity theft doesn't just occur by Social Security and credit card numbers. As identity federation or single sign-on becomes more prevalent in these various directory stores, such as those maintained by Microsoft, compromising a single account or identity store could potentially gain access to multiple services. For example, Microsoft's Azure AD was the target of a research at last year's Black Hat USA in a talk entitled The Active Directory Botnet. Microsoft is clearly serious about closing any such holes in our identity services in the future, and this newest bug bounty program should help improve overall security going forward. The significant payouts possible in this program balance any temptation there might be to sell or exploit a zero-day vulnerability a researcher might discover.
Well, darn. D-Link has some stolen certificates. And as if botnets made up of IoT devices like cameras weren't bad enough, now someone has managed to obtain crypto certificates from D-Link to send out malware as firmware updates. Quote, somehow members of an advanced persistent threat hacking group known as Black Tech obtained the certificates belonging to D-Link and Changing Information Technology, the researchers with antivirus provider ESET said in a blog post. The attackers then used the certificates to sign two pieces of malware, one a remotely controlled backdoor and the other a related password stealer. Both pieces of malware are referred to as Plead and are used in espionage campaigns against targets located in East Asia. The Japan Computer Emergency Response Team recently documented the Plead malware here. AV provider Trend Micro recently wrote about Black Tech in another location. The ability to compromise several Taiwan-based technology companies and reuse their code signing certificates in future attacks shows that this group is highly skilled and focused on that region, ESET researcher Anton Cherepov wrote in Monday's post.
Now, we've all heard about China's methods of using facial recognition, artificial intelligence, smart glasses, and other technologies to monitor its 1.4 billion citizens, with the aim of one day giving each of them a personal score based on how they behave. Now, it might come as no surprise that China found another way to surveil its citizens in areas where its cameras networks could not reach them. All you have to do is look up. It might look like a bird, but instead it's a high surveillance drone made to look like a dove. Dubbed Dove, the new program uses bird-like drones that mimic the flapping wings of real birds using a pair of crank rockers driven by electric motors. Each drone has a high-definition camera, GPS antenna, flight control system, and a data link with satellite communication capabilities. Although this is still in the test phase, the new drones are a method of filling the coverage gaps that other surveillance mediums cannot fill. If nothing else, this takes the government surveillance to a frightening new level.
Emergency service responders are at risk due to weaknesses in cellular gateways of IoT devices. This vulnerability in Sierra Wireless cellular gateways installed in many IoT devices was first discovered in emergency services vehicles by F5 Labs researcher Justin Shattuck in 2016. The root of most of these flaws is either weak or non-existent authentication to the cellular gateways themselves. At the time of the report presented at Black Hat USA yesterday, over 100,000 devices were online and known to be vulnerable. 86% of these devices are in the U.S. Since they are often used to track fleet vehicles, many of these devices also leak information such as GPS coordinates without authentication, including the coordinates of police cruisers and ambulances. These gateways are also connected to other systems inside those vehicles, such as the radio. Perhaps more surprisingly, these cellular gateways were also discovered in use as a connectivity infrastructure, such as traffic lights. The potential for abuse of these systems is obvious, and Shattuck suspects that they've been exploited by attackers since at least August of 2016. Compounding matters is that these devices often have no logging facility available, which renders any attempt at tracking attack activity fruitless. To their credit, Sierra Wireless has issued multiple security advisories regarding these vulnerabilities, and newer devices are shipping with secure by default configurations, such as disabled management interfaces. Unfortunately, the fix isn't as easy as deploying a patch, since there isn't a single cause to blame in this instance. The danger of connecting poorly secured devices directly to the internet continues to grow, and threat research such as this from F5 Labs should help improve awareness of this threat.
A decades-old Bluetooth flaw has been letting hackers steal data passing between devices. A large number of device makers are patching a serious vulnerability in the Bluetooth specification that allows attackers to intercept and tamper with data exchanged wirelessly. People who use Bluetooth to connect smartphones, computers, or other security-sensitive devices should make sure they install a fix as soon as possible. The attack, which was disclosed in a research paper published this last Wednesday, is serious because it allows people to perform a man-in-the-middle attack on the connection between the vulnerable devices. From there, attackers can view any exchanged data, which might include contacts stored on a device, passwords typed on a keyboard, or sensitive information used by medical, point-of-sale, or automotive equipment. Attackers could also forge keystrokes on a Bluetooth keyboard to open up a command window or malicious website in an outright compromise of the connected phone or computer. Yet another reason to update quickly.
So people know about common attacks like phishing and email malware, documents, scripting exploits, and weak passwords as ways to get into your accounts and email. With two-factor, it becomes harder because now attackers have to gain access to a third-party system in order to break through. Instead of trying to beat that system, why not work around it using your phone number to do it? SIM hijacking is a little-known but growing threat. This kind of hack is what's called a port of scam, an expression derived from the concept of porting a number from one carrier to another, and is also known as SIM swapping or hijacking. Ultimately, this hack relies on scammers tricking a carrier's tech support into allowing them another SIM on the same account for the same number. By hijacking a mobile phone number, the hijackers are able to seize social networking accounts like Instagram and other accounts like Amazon, eBay, PayPal, and Hulu, Netflix, and more. Even two-factor authentication can be beat by this hijacking of a phone number. Now, there are ways to make it harder for attackers to hijack your SIM phone number, so consider these methods today. It might not be a bad idea. Now, carriers like AT&T allow customers to add a passcode to their account. Now, this is a credential that's separate from the password you use to log into your accounts online. Now, this passcode will be required to make significant changes to the account, such as porting the number to a different SIM and other items. Now, another method to slow down hackers is don't link your mobile number to your online accounts. Use a VoIP number instead. This way, it's harder to hijack that number. As well as, use an authenticator app. That requires a master password or even biometrics to two-factor auth you rather than using SMS messages. Now, if anything else, this slows down attackers and causes them to fight more for what that workaround is for them to get in. And in this day and age, having hackers work harder can sometimes be a deterrent to target other accounts. Well, folks, that does it for the blips, but next up, the bites. But first, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that's LastPass. Now, we just did an article on issues with people using bad passwords or not so great passwords. And in fact, sometimes losing a password is the number one reason for breaching it. Now, and I actually use this tool. This is a great tool. It's one of my favorite tools. It helps me remember my username and passwords for each and every site. I have 5 different bank accounts, and I need to use a different username and password for every one of those sites. And I can't remember all of those, and I don't want to write them down somewhere. I will lose them. I want to put them in email while I can get it hacked. That's where LastPass is really strong. And all you have to do is remember that master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. Now, I got hooked on it when I started using it on the desktop because then I didn't have to remember all the passwords to all the sites. But I also used it on my mobile devices. It made it easier for me to log into bank accounts, pretty much any account I needed to log into. And not only did it support mobile browsers, but it also supports Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Opera, and more on your desktop. Plus, it works great with your mobile phone, Android, and iOS. Now, I remember the day I was called at work. My family needed a password to get into the bank account to make a payment. Did I remember? Nope. I couldn't remember that password. I didn't remember that account at all. All I had to do was visit LastPass Vault, use my one and only master password, and bam, I could remember that password. All I had to do is give them that password. They were able to make the payment. Done. Now, I'm talking about my personal use account. But they also have LastPass families for the entire family. And LastPass also works great and amazing for enterprises too. Now, enterprises are always battling people trying to breach their networks. Over 81% of breaches are caused by weak or reused passwords. Now, LastPass makes it easier. They provide a unique random password generator. Employees don't have to remember it or write it down. Plus, they also offer a multi-factor auth. Now, get this. Employees can now log into LastPass with their Microsoft Active Directory credentials, so they can truly only have one password to remember, their AD password. Now, also with LastPass Enterprise, you can configure over 100 policies, access security reports, create shared folders. You can secure a ton of stuff, including organizational database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, and other important business information. And the data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. So the data is stored in a vault and it's kept secret from even LastPass. So from easy onboarding to password autofill, LastPass makes it easier for businesses to take control of passwords and reduce the threat of a breach. Now, honestly, I love this tool. I need LastPass. I use LastPass. LastPass is one of my favorite tools, and I'm a user for life. Now, no wonder LastPass is celebrating their 10-year anniversary this past July. Great software, great service. More than 13 million people trust LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit today. That's LastPass.com/twit and see which product is right for you. And we thank LastPass for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, now it's time for the bites. We have a pretty doozy today. We talk about the growing concern over the last several years of national voter fraud. And, you know, due to this growing concern, lawmakers are sensitive to any accusations when things don't look right. Well, if anything doesn't look right, it's the 243% turnout rate over in Georgia's 2018 primary election. Now, I don't know about you, but that kind of institutes a microscope that's going on that process. And it now that it's turned on them, it seems that this is due to inflated voter numbers, phony ballots, and poor voter machines. Now, a federal lawsuit against the state has begun to turn up evidence of a number of notable problems with the primary voting procedure. Georgia's just one of four states that use voting machines which cannot or do not provide a paper proof of vote, which makes it harder to audit. And they use 16-year-old machines, which have suffered from freezes and crashes on election days. Now, information about the poor security of these machines has mysteriously disappeared over last year's investigation. Now, Georgia's Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, has promised to conduct a bipartisan investigation into changing voter machines before the 2020 elections. But that doesn't fix the 2018 elections. Now, I want to throw this over to Cheaper because, you know, Cheaper, you put this in here. And I think that, as noted, these are 16-year-old machines. This problem has been around for a long time. There's probably no silver bullet to fix this problem, right?
No, I don't think so. The my personal opinion is JJ to the 4884. Come on, man. Go and help your state government fix this voter fraud problem. Now, this is, come on. Electronic voting isn't rocket science. We got to get away from these paper audit trails. There's really no reason why we couldn't just write to, a worm drive of some sort, some optical, so that it can only be written once and read many. You know, I don't see why not. There's a lot of things that can be done, and 243% voter turnout for a precinct is that's a big giant red flag. And electronic voting doesn't have to give state government such big black eyes. There's a lot of technology out there. Let's start thinking about adopting some of it. And, you know, the one thing that does make me say, is, yeah, maybe it is time to finally break down and start taking a really, really hard look at cryptographic ID systems.
Right. You know, I kind of think that having the auditing process is useful, right? So you're having these kind of manual paper versions of these things, you can go back and look and actually audit it. Now, I want to throw it over to Bam because here, you know, this is what organizations use today. They have logs that they go back and audit systems based off of those logs. So having both a hard copy and a soft copy of it would provide a kind of a double check system there, right? I mean, there's got to be ways to just incrementally improve this and not have to spend millions and billions of dollars to actually have to audit these processes, right?
Yeah, I get the feeling sometimes that we're trying to digitize too much or digitize things for the sake of digitizing them. So is this really a problem? Were paper ballots really that flawed, or paper ballots actually maybe easier to audit, easier to verify than these electronic systems with less vulnerabilities because we can more accurately track, you know, physical access than we are currently able to track, you know, digital or electronic access. So that's my concern, is that maybe we're overcomplicating the problem. You know, and I'm a big anti-paper guy. I get a hand cramp the second I pick up a pen. So I'm not, you know, somebody that's a Luddite here, but sometimes you got to kind of look at, are we trying to solve a problem that doesn't really exist? I also can get, you know, as much as I like the promise of blockchain for really verifiable transactions, I wonder, does this disenfranchise certain voters who may not have the same access to the internet that we sort of consider, you know, right next to breathing and water and other necessities? There's a lot of people that still, you know, struggle to, you know, get access to voting with the way it is now. And so I worry that, you know, we may be, you know, disenfranchising certain sections of the population by saying, oh, you need this new cryptographic thing. And a lot of people struggle to use computers or connect to the internet, even today in 2018.
Right. I mean, I think if you think about it, like, I think you're right. I think we are kind of overcomplicating the situation. I think, you know, we maybe have to look into why they moved to electronic voting in the original sense. And I think that's mainly because they wanted to increase the speed and supposedly the accuracy of the voting systems. But you're right. Like, I think that having an online kind of basically buckets people, told people only have access to technologies. You don't want to do that. And even here in Washington State, you can send in your ballot. In fact, the only way to kind of vote is via mail here. So that provides kind of a manual mechanism there. But again, I'm sure that they electronically register and those votes once they get them. But the question here is, again, some of these states, they have either you go to a booth, you electronically do it there, or you do it electronically online. You're right. I think it might be overcomplicating. Now, Chiba, you're kind of on the other camp of things. You're like, hey, we shouldn't be doing anything manual here. I think that everything should be electronic and we should just secure it better. And you kind of alluded to this. Hey, cryptographic IDs might be one way. You know, possibly blockchain is one of the other ones that people are alluding to. Is do you think that that's the solution, or is it just kind of adding to the fire?
I'm actually more in the middle. I like the idea of electronic voting mostly because I was not able to vote in my state elections for many, many, many years in a row because I was serving overseas. And the number of, you know, state citizens that are on travel for work, on travel for military, vacation, whatever, lots and lots and lots of reasons. We need to provide for that because I'm one of these people. I want to vote. I really want to vote because my voice is my vote. And not being able to vote just because I was serving overseas really bugged me. So I want electronic voting, but I don't want a flawed system either. So whatever's. And Emily DeStrange, no, I did not. I served during the Clinton administration, and I'm really embarrassed when I go overseas and say, no, I didn't vote for him.
Well, you know, again, we might be just overcomplicating. So I think, you know, potential these kind of absentee ballot mechanisms are always a way to fix that problem. But again, there's always going to be a state that has one way to do it. Each state's going to do it differently here and there. So I think that, we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, hopefully these systems that are having these issues will at least be reconciled as we move forward in the different elections, but we'll have to see. Well, let's jump in the next bite, because I think this is also an interesting one. We talk a lot about how the government is affecting big business and potentially even the telecom market. Now, we talked a little bit about Charter. Now, they're ranked as the second largest cable operator after Comcast. They report over 27 million residential and business customers from coast to coast. But its problems began in New York when it acquired Time Warner Cable back in 2015 for $57 billion. Now, Charter Communications purchased Time Warner Cable, but they potentially are one of the most disruptive purchases in the history of telecom under fire. Now, it's under fire because in the past several weeks, the New York State Public Service Commission voted to revoke its approval of the sale. Now, the reason for the revoke, they have a laundry list of stuff here. I'll try to go through some of them. Now, the company's repeated failures to meet deadlines, Charter's attempts to skirt obligations to serve rural communities, unsafe practices in the field, its failure to fully commit to its obligations under the 2016 merger agreement, and the company's purposeful obfuscation of its performance and compliance obligations to the commission and its customers. Now, and Charter insists that it actually hit its deadlines and it remains in compliance. But if the threat of making Spectrum forfeit its cable franchise wasn't enough, Charter Spectrum is also facing secondary serious allegations by the state attorney general themselves. Now, Chibert, is this going to be enough to move such a large company and actually send a message so that they can start doing the right thing here? Because a lot of these deals, they just say, oh, yeah, we'll do that. As long as you approve this thing, we'll do it. And then they go and do it, and then nothing happens thereafter. So this is the way New York State is handling it. They're saying, you know what? You're violating all these things, so we just don't approve it anymore. You can go do your thing, but you're not going to be able to be the same entity. And the only way to do it is to start doing these things. Is this a way to send a message? Does every state have to do this?
I don't know. I hope not. But the bottom line is New York State's Attorney General, what do they call them? In Hawaii, we call it the Public Utilities Commission. But they got to do something. And sadly, it looks like they're using this case as an example, and I gotta imagine, all the things I've been reading, lots and lots and lots of states are looking at what New York is doing and saying, maybe this will work. So there's a lot of wait and see. The fact that these companies are not fulfilling the terms of their contract, if you're a smaller company, you didn't, comply to the terms of your contract in New York State, you'd get shut down in a heartbeat. But if you're a multi-billion dollar corporation, you get slapped on the wrist. I think it's time to level the playing field, and to the folks in New York State, good luck.
I agree. I think this gives more options to consumers, because you're kind of pushing the enterprise with these large telecoms to do the right thing, especially if they're violating some of the rules that they agreed to do. Bam, I want to throw this over to you, because I think, you deal with a lot of networking, a lot of companies, a lot of telecoms out there. Good quality networking is hard to find. So especially in rural areas, Charter promised to do it, right? They promised to make this better. And then as long as they promised to do that, they could get their merger approved. Do you think that this is fair that they're being, targeted and being held accountable?
I'm not one to be in favor of a lot of regulation, but I got to say that the cable companies in particular have been playing with house money for a long time. I dealt with this in my past life, running IT for various small, medium-sized companies. And often to get good service, I'd have to, go and get waivers and have one cable company come in and get waivers to pull cable in a few hundred yards across some imaginary boundary where they didn't have rights to come in. And it's a real nightmare for somebody that's on the enterprise side. For somebody that's a regular consumer, they have no options, right? They have whatever's there. They're not getting any waivers signed. They're not doing anything like that. So there's really this true monopoly system Verizon Fios, you know, because they're not technically a cable company, has kind of come in and disrupted that. And, you know, other fiber to the home services, you know, Google's service have kind of come in and provided like real broadband competition. But where I live, I don't have a choice, right? So in my home, I have, you know, I'm using Comcast cable because the only other option aside from satellite-based internet access is DSL, which maxes out at 1 meg download speeds, which clearly are not going to keep up with the demands of my type of work and also everything that me and my wife and my children all stream all the time and download and so on and so on. So, you know, right now I'm paying the only game in town. And when things like this, and this is really not too distant from a really hot button topic like net neutrality, we start to look at, you know, we really do have to hold these companies to their commitments so that they deliver things. And it goes back to even the previous bite, right? We talked about, you know, electronic voter IDs, and now we're talking about, hey, there's people in rural areas that are not getting the internet access they should. So this is, you know, proof point one that good, solid internet access is something that's become a fundamental, I won't say right, but having the option for it should be something that is provided for just like, you know, other utilities.
Right. I'm kind of glad you brought that up because I think net neutrality is a good example of this because, you know, a lot of people have more than one option in their area. They pay for premium service. They pay for the 100 megabit. They pay for the gigabyte services, but they don't get the quality service. They don't get consistent speeds. Things drop down. And when they call in, you know, these companies say, hey, well, these are just meant for things to load faster. It's not that we meant for large downloads of data. We just want things to go a little faster for you. And I think that's just kind of the consensus of what's going on with net neutrality is, hey, not only will you pay for premium service, but you maybe even later on pay for, you know, faster lanes to Netflix or faster lanes to this or faster lanes to that. And it's just ways for telecoms to create harder problems for consumers and more expensive problems. And so only the people who have the money who can do it will get the premium and sometimes not even guaranteed to get the premium. So, Cheaper, I want to throw this over to you because, you know, do you think that keeping these two companies separate, it forces them to be competitors and it forces them for a little bit more competition in the market, which is sometimes better for consumers? And then this way, you know, maybe one company in the market or these even the smaller telecoms can say start doing the right thing and not being charged customers for these things. And then at least the bigger telecoms will get the message. Is this just more of a net neutrality thing? Is it a competitive thing? Where do you think is the benefit of keeping them separate?
I think one of the things that's going to happen or starting to happen that's going to be really, really interesting is the FTC seems to be starting to feel their oats. And, you know, some of the blips and bites that we've done in the last half a year or so, if you read between the lines, it almost feels like the FTC is going to start implementing something along the lines of GDPR. Now, the reason why I bring this up is there's a interesting trend that's starting to happen. I'm actually knee deep in one of them, well, hip deep, with the advent of 5G. I was talking to some of the folks in the chat room about that. 5G right out of the gate is going to be more for distribution than it is to the endpoints. But having the 5G to go out and get things out into the world is going to be really interesting, especially for the wireless internet service provider, a WISP. I'm actually in the process of working with some friends here in Honolulu on designing the back-end network for a WISP. And with the new millimeter, you know, especially the 60 gigahertz stuff, we have the bandwidth so that I – in theory, can provide gigabit symmetrical to the home for the cost that you could get, say, a Charter cable modem. So I'm hoping what happens is that the states feel that maybe there is another way. They don't have to go through the morass of pole attaches or these less pole attach issues. And then maybe, just maybe, the equivalent of the public utilities commissions in different states are going to say, hey, you guys aren't playing to the tune of this contract. You don't have a monopoly anymore. we're going to open it up and you guys must provide them, you know, the horizontal. So that's going to be really interesting. And I got to imagine this coming year, the blips and the bites are going to have an awful lot on this topic.
I agree as well. Now, I've had business internet for a while because of there's SLA, the service uptime, there's quality of service requirements. Now, I pay more for less speeds, but I don't have any TV or I don't have any phone service. I just have this really high quality a business service. And the reason why I do that is because I go in and start paying for services like YouTube TV or DirecTV Now. And I think, Brian, you brought this, Bam, you actually brought this up a little bit, is, you know, especially with this type of merger and with the net neutrality rules going down the toilet, it makes it easier for companies like this, right, to start regulating and blocking services like this. So now it makes it hard for cord cutters, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're a cord cutter family. And you know, we've just found that after a while, all we do is stream stuff anyway. So why continue to pay for television service from the cable company? And so we went through the process, but I just imagine a day when, you know, my cable provider says, hey, we don't want you getting local channels from DirecTV Now. Why not? You know, we can just squash, you know, make that stream perform poorly. It's very easy for them to identify which byte stream it is, so they can squash that without damaging the rest of the service they provide me over the internet, and force me back to them for, you know, local TV service, which seems very, you know, sort of anti-free market, if you ask me. And the free market economy and capitalism, isn't that what, you know, part of, you know, our values as Americans?
Right. Well, I agree with Chibert. I think this topic is not going to go away, and I'm sure we're going to hear more and more about it as the years go on, even as legislation changes for it. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we get our guest to come in and drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do that, we have to actually thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, home buying is not easy. It's quite stressful. And when I was buying my last house, I had to deal with multiple banks and multiple representatives from the banks. I had to go search for data all around my house and different file cabinets and have to send out different information, each one of them. It was very stressful. It seemed like it takes forever. And it was very stressful. So with interest rates on the rise, it also creates even more unpredictability in the market when you're buying a house, and it creates more anxiety. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage noticed this issue, and they decided to try to change some of it. And they're calling it the power buying process. Now, here's how it works. Quicken Loans will verify your income, assets, and credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval. What is that? Well, it essentially gives you the strength of a cash buyer. In this current market, that's a huge advantage as a buyer, because sometimes you have to put in offers right at open houses at a moment's notice. And so this gives you that power. Now, once you're verified, you're qualified for the all new exclusive Rate Shield approval as well. Now, first, they lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now, here's the best part. If the rate goes up during that time, your rate stays the same. But if the rate goes down, your rate also drops. Now, either way, you win. Now, that's the kind of thinking you kind of expect from America's largest mortgage lender, Rocket Mortgage. Now, even if you're thinking about buying a house, go out there right now to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Now, it takes you less than 10 minutes and your info could be entered in. You're on your way to that home buying freedom. Now, again, to get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we get to my favorite part of the show. That's bring a guest on to actually talk to the Twilight Riot. And that's today we actually bring on Sammy Ahmed, co-founder of Hunt Club. Sammy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lou. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, today we're going to talk about something interesting, because we talked about in our blips and bites in the past about talent acquisition, how we go about finding the right talent for the right job. And that's a hard thing, especially when you move up in executive level and higher, it becomes even harder to find really good talent in the field. Now, Hunt Club's doing this a little differently. Want to tell us a little bit about the business and how you guys are doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Hunt Club, kind of who we are, and it's huntclub.com for the listeners out there, and the Twilight Ride, which, by the way, I love that that name. But we're essentially a new category of talent firms where we tap into the networks of the most connected business leaders in the world that refer out of their own networks for your open role. So we call this group of business leaders influencers. And with every referral an influencer makes, they're eligible to earn $2,000 to $5,000 for a referral that lands a job. And if their referral doesn't land the job and gets interviewed, they'll still earn $100 to $300 depending on the level of the role. So in our model, and a little bit different than, I think, traditional recruiting, candidates get rewarded. Candidates get a great new opportunity, companies get a great new employee, and firms get rewarded. So everybody's aligned, and essentially everybody wins.
Right. Now, we've talked a little bit about in the past, like, obviously, as a person who's in tech field, I have my profile on lots of different places, LinkedIn, all the different kind of different job sites that are out there today. And when I want to go look for a job, or maybe even headhunters look for people, they look to these sites for that information. Now, how do you decide who an influencer is, and how do you kind of bring them in and make use out of them?
Great question. So we have a gated approach where influencers will essentially join our platform. We'll review their backgrounds, understand who they are, understand what their networks look like, and then the value it can provide to our influencers and the community itself. And then based on that, you're approved into that closed network. So people can go on to huntclub.com/influencers and apply. And then essentially from there, we kind of take the process here internally.
Interesting. Now, I can tell you right now, like, now that my profile is out on these sites, I at least once a day, maybe even twice a day, I'll get calls or maybe emails or messages from different headhunters saying, hey, I have this job. If you're interested, check it out. Otherwise, forward it on to somebody that you think is good for it. And sometimes I do. And sometimes I'm even incentivized to do that. Now, how is this process a little different? Now, how are you guys kind of circumventing that whole process? And you have this kind of network and influencers. Do you provide incentives to influencers? Like, what is kind of the forcing function for them?
Yeah, great question. So I think the reality is that, most of our influencers, they're already doing this out of their own goodwill, probably like you do yourself, Lou, connect with people in their network for awesome opportunities and, not expecting anything out of it. But we do believe that their action deserves some form of gratitude. So influencers will receive what we call a paid forward reward. So anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000 per referral. That does land a job. And as I mentioned, 100 to 300 for any referral that does get interviewed. I think influencers, as I mentioned, they're already doing it. We've created kind of a frictionless process that doesn't really have them do any of the heavy lifting. So our technology allows us to identify who in your network would be good for a specific role. And then we'll serve that up to influencers. And all they really have to do is approve the referral. And then our team will take it from there.
Fantastic. Now, what's the business model for Hunt Club now that you kind of obviously you get these people in, you do some research about them, you make sure that they're influencers, and then you kind of have a small payout if it's successful. Now, how are you guys making money?
Yeah, so we're working it with two sides of the market, right? So we're working with influencers on one side who are the referrers, and then we're working with companies themselves on the other side. So our companies range from seed stage startups to enterprise organizations. We've worked with and currently work with everyone from Dollar Shave Club to Pinterest to Flywheel to companies like Everything But The House and ShipBob here locally in Chicago, G2 Crowd, and this goes kind of on and on. And so we have a couple of business models, some that are purely based on search. So we're paid essentially on the success of putting a candidate into a specific role. And then we've got traditional RPO models where we come in and kind of take on an entire organization's recruiting process end to end. And that typically is when you don't have an existing recruiting department, you want to outsource that to someone like Hunt Club.
Got it. Now for me, my hacker mindset, sometimes I think about, hey, how can I potentially, if I need a job and I want to maybe hire maybe an executive level job, how can I potentially hack the system, I guess you could say. In this case, it sounds like if there's an influencer out there, I could potentially maybe approach them and say, hey, like, if there's a job that you hear about, can you let me know about it? Is this something that you guys are worried about, that you maybe, hey, I've already established this relationship with an influencer, and they're obviously ones that we trust to give us potential candidates here. And you guys do call it a club. And so to me, it sounds like, hey, like, in order to get entry in this club, you need somebody to kind of get you an entry. And so as a candidate, I kind of want to find a way to get into that club. And so is there maybe some exclusivity there? Are you guys worried about that part of it?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And, you know, I think for us, you know, right now we don't work directly with candidates. As I mentioned, we work with influencers and then with the companies themselves. And so we're going to be opening up actually a candidate portal here soon where candidates can, you know, kind of actively apply to join Hunt Club or apply for a specific job itself. But I think the cool thing about our model is, you know, kind of the power of that referral, right? And you think about, you know, your own life, right? Like you're happy with what you're doing, but there's probably a handful of people that they came to you and said, hey, Luke, you know, you got to take a look at this. You know them, you trust them, you respect them. And because of that, you know, you'll take the 10, 15 minutes to listen to whatever it is that this individual is presenting. And then we kind of take that process and convert that passive candidate into an active candidate. So we've created our own proprietary platform and technology that automates the parts that make sense to be automated. And then once we get a candidate engaged via that influencer, a services team takes over, and that's kind of where the human element kind of drives the process from there on out.
Interesting. Now, Chiba, you had a couple of questions about kind of the matching of those job skills, right?
Yeah. So one of my biggest complaints about the headhunting process is that, you know, I tell people, no. I'm really not a programmer. Could you please take me off that? You know, for the influencers, is there a feedback mechanism so that you can fine tune the candidates, shall we say?
Yeah, absolutely there is, Brian. So our internal platform has an algorithm, you know, built in it that we built that essentially matches a job spec to, you know, who in that person's network could be a good fit. And so when an influencer gets a referral request, they have the opportunity to say, yes, Brian's great for this role. No, he's not. Or, you know, there's a more options button. In that more options button, you can actually specify, like, hey, you know what, actually, I don't know Brian, I've never met Brian, or whatever the rationale is. And then our platform will track that and then essentially make our influencers as well as the candidate portion of it smarter. So that way, you know, we're not tapping the same people to either ask them for introductions or tapping the same candidates that, you know, in kind of your example, might not be the right fit.
Now, Brian McHenry, you actually had a question about how do organizations get involved, right?
Yeah, so I'm actually recently become a hiring manager, and finding good candidates, as you can imagine, is really a huge challenge, and you're helping to solve that. So, you know, what does it look like from a hiring manager's perspective? What's the, you know, what's the interface, the engagement model? How do I give you the best job description that helps you match to the right candidate? What does that look like?
Yeah, great question, Brian. So I think the biggest thing about Hunt Club and, you know, kind of the reason why, you know, we built this business is I think, you know, we saw a lot of things in recruiting that were, you know, quite frankly broken and that were broken for quite a bit of time. And so the one thing we always say at Hunt Club is, you know, the best candidates are the ones that aren't looking. And, you know, we firmly believe that. So, you know, how do you tap into passive candidates? It's not by being transactional, but it's by being consultative, you know, not just with candidates, but also with companies itself. So whenever we have an engagement with any customer, our talent team, and you'll have a dedicated team for every engagement, they'll take a deeper dive into that organization, understand what the role is intimately, what the job requires, not just what the job is skill-wise, but what are the actual projects that this individual will be tackling, understanding their culture. So that way, when we go out into the market and look for these candidates via our influencer network, you know, we're checking all the boxes that we know are important. So you as a hiring manager, Brian, you're not spending time with hundreds of candidates that, you know, don't meet the mark, but you're spending your time with the top 3 to 5 candidates that are referred, vetted, engaged, and, you know, kind of ready to go. You know, it's a slam dunk for you guys from there.
Now, what about, go ahead, Brian, you had another question?
No, I'm good. Go ahead.
Okay. So what about like the levels of positions? So, we've been kind of talking about how do influencers get connected with candidates. Now, these types of candidates, we're talking about higher level positions like executive level or director level types things, or these are potential like individual contribution type things as well?
Yeah, so we do a wide variety of searches, Brian. So we started off kind of focused kind of in that kind of more executive tier, focusing on executive level roles all the way down to, call it director level. We've since kind of broadened our scope and, we do some individual contributor roles. I'd say the bulk of our roles tend to still kind of, steer in that director level and above. But I think as we grow, so will obviously kind of our suite of services, which I think is going to certainly be able to accommodate some of those individual contributor roles and some of the lower level roles.
Say we've got someone we've got an influencer that managed to make it in, but they're gaming the system. Is there some sort of grading or feedback process so you can, start grading the influencers and what their feedback is worth?
Yeah, no, there absolutely is, Brian. And, it's funny because I think when people hear the model, they assume that everyone just clicks yes because, whoever on the other end is, chasing those rewards. But you'd be surprised, right? Because you actually get more no's than I think you'd imagine. And so we do actually have a scoring system here internally that lets us know how engaged influencers are, what their response rate and successes are. We've also got a scoring system internally that allows us to see if that influencer actually knows the candidate. So, if we're going out and we find a great candidate and we've got, five different influencers connected with this candidate, we can see clearly through a series of attributes and criteria that we've set that allow us to see who is the best person to actually refer this individual, who actually knows this person, or are they just connected on LinkedIn and that's why they're showing up in kind of as a connection. And so, yeah, to answer your question, I think that there's not a lot of people out there that are gaming the system yet, but, we certainly keep a close eye on that.
Right, but okay, so let's play devil's advocate here.
Sure.
Somehow or another, a candidate finds out that someone's an influencer on Hunt Club,
mm-hmm.
and says, I'm going to throw a whole bunch of money at you to go and make me sound like I can walk on water. What do you think? Any kind of mechanisms for that?
Yeah, for sure. So I think it's part technology, it's part services, right? And so part of our team, once that influencer says, yes, Brian is good for the role, we're not piping that candidate directly to our customers yet. Our talent team then screens that candidate against what we know is important to the customer. So if in the event, Brian, you're referred for a job, we think you're great on paper, but then we talk to you and screen you and we realize, Brian might not be right for the job. Brian, you won't get past our services team. So the influencer wouldn't actually earn anything in that case. They only earn if the candidate's connected to the client themselves.
So what about also, my question's kind of similar, but it's more around sometimes that level of job, executive level, director level, to me, it's actually, it's actually a small world out there. And when it comes to business, those types of business, and granted, there's a lot of positions, but when it comes to actually organizations bringing people in for these positions, sometimes they're looking for something very specific, and that exclusivity becomes a very small candidate pool. And that small candidate pool becomes, again, kind of just a set of people that are out there. So, and you kind of talked a little bit about how the fact that Hunt Club is looking for, those people, those passive people, people who are not looking for jobs, but maybe supplying them the new opportunity by getting recommendations. Do you kind of worry that maybe you're not tapping the entire market, maybe the people that are looking to kind of move up into those roles that do have the potential to do the job, and then you're missing that part of the market?
No, I think that we still, when we say, we think the best candidates are the ones that aren't looking, that is something, we believe, but I think that there's something to be said about active candidates as well. I think there's a number of great active candidates out there. So I think by leveraging our networks, we're unlocking those folks that aren't looking for a job, but we're certainly also tapping with the people that, you know, may be actively looking. So I think we've got a pretty wide scope across kind of the candidate pool that's out there. So I don't think we're actually missing out on that. But, you know, again, I think that it's kind of dependent on the customer we're working for and what they're looking for and the speed at which they'd like to hire in terms of where we look to find our sources of candidates.
Got it. Well, first of all, we're running a little bit low on time, but I did want to give you a chance. So let's talk about an organization who wants to get involved. They're looking for somebody. They're looking for to fill a really good high-level position. It's been really hard to find a candidate. How do they go and get started? What do they do to get Hunt Club involved?
Yeah, they can visit huntclub.com. There is an intake form that you can fill out. You can certainly email me directly as well at sami@huntclub.com, and I'd be happy to chat with you and pipe you in with, you know, our head of BD to kind of chat through the opportunity, and certainly would love to help you guys find a rock star.
Fantastic. Well, folks, unfortunately, we have run out of time. You've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise show, according to the 9 out of 10 job candidates. I also want to thank our panelists for dropping some knowledge on the Twilight Riot, starting with one of my co-hosts in crime, Mr. Brian Chiebert. You know, always a pleasure having you on, sir. Thank you for being here. And of course, thank you for doing such a great job as our producer. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
I am ADVNETLAB at Twitter, but I'm also Chiebert at twit.tv or Twiet at twit.tv. I'll answer to either one. And I'd like to leave these words of wisdom that came as a random post on Facebook. It's from Maastricht University. It's a big poster that I desperately want to get a copy of. It says, treat your passwords like your underwear. Never share them with anyone. Change them regularly and keep them off your desk.
That's
great.
Awesome.
Great advice. Thanks, Chiebert. Of course, I got to thank our newest co-host in crime, Mr. Brian McHenry. Bam. Thank you for being here, sir. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Thanks, Lou. You can, as always, find me on Twitter at BA McHenry, as well as over on devcentral.f5.com, where me and my team, we post up videos and blogs about how to make really complex F5 solutions seem really simple. And if you're looking for some deep thoughts about information security, I'm also on informationsecuritybuzz.com.
Fantastic. Thanks, Brian. Well, of course, we have to thank our great guest for today, Sammy. Great show. Thank you for being here. This is your 30 seconds. Give you a chance to kind of tell us about where they can find you, where you can find your work, and a little bit about Hunt Club.
Sure. So thanks for having me, Lou, Brian, and Brian. You know, you guys can find us at huntclub.com. My email directly if you'd like to chat, whether it's your company out there hiring or an influencer looking to get involved. It's sami@huntclub.com. And would love to welcome all of you out there to join Hunt Club as an influencer. That includes you, Lou, Brian, and Brian. So you'll be getting an email from me after this to definitely join the network. But again, like, I think our goal here is to change recruiting for the better, and we can't do it without amazing companies that we support and the influencers out there that, you know, kind of make this thing go. So appreciate the time, and thanks again for having me.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for being here. Well, folks, also thank you to you. You tune in each and every week. We couldn't do this show without you. You are loyal listeners and viewers, and we want to make sure we make it easy for you to tune in each and every week. So go right now to our show page, twit.tv/Twiet. You find all of our back episodes, all the show notes, of course, all the guest information, and of course, all of the stories that we do during the show and links to those stories. But more importantly, next to the videos there's that magic button. Subscribe to the format of your choice, whether it's audio, video, HD video, and on the device of your choice, phone, tablet, or desktop, laptop. And of course, after you subscribe, share the show with your friends and family and coworkers, because we love doing this show. And with your support, we can keep doing it. Now, after you subscribe, also remember, we do the show live each and every week at 1:30 Pacific at live.twit.tv. And you want to come see how the pizza is made? Well, come see right away, because you can see what's going on behind the scenes before and after the show. See how goofy we are doing the show here. Of course, joining the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You hear us pulling questions from there all the time. Sometimes we change the direction of the show as we listen to the chat room. So come see how great the chat room is and stop by and say hi. Also, don't forget to follow me, all of my interesting discussions at twitter.com/LouMM. You can see all my work that I do at Microsoft on my daily job at dev.office.com. See how you can customize Office and the Office experience and make it more productive for you. Also, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially Leo and Lisa. They keep supporting us each and every week to continue to do This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we thank you for their support. Also, I want to thank all the engineers at Twit for making the show possible, especially to our producer, Mr. Brian Chi. Thank you so much for doing such a great job and finding some great guests here for us on This Week in Enterprise Tech. And before we sign out, I have to thank RTD for today. Kevin, welcome back, sir. Tradition, got to ask, what's the show about today?
It's about Kevin needing to go do something and Alex taking over at the end of the show.
Well, that's okay, Alex. But, you know, it's okay. It was all about making sure you don't air your dirty laundry and leave your passwords laying out.
Well, that's what I meant.
Well, folks, it was great having you here. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.